It's Tuesday, April 19, 2016. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The issue of race or gender-based abortion is back in the headlines. This time, the headline comes from NBC News. It has to do with an act pending before the United States Congress that goes by the acronym PRENDA, that is, the Prenatal Non-Discrimination Act. It is legislation that would criminalize any abortion that is undertaken for the sole reasons of the race or gender of the unborn child. As Francis Kahwa Wang reports for NBC, on Thursday, Representatives Judy Chu, Democrat of California, Loretta Sanchez, Democrat of California, and Sheila Jackson Lee, also a Democrat, but she of Texas, as well as advocates for Asian American, Latino, and African American women, spoke out against House Resolution 4924, also known as PRENDA, which they characterize as racist and anti-choice, that according to the office of Congresswoman Chu. On the same day, the report from NBC tells us, the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution and Civil Justice held a hearing on the bill. Now, at this point, NBC seeks to define the bill. Now, we look back to the fact that in recent days we have talked about similar legislation adopted by the legislature in Indiana and signed into law by Indiana Governor Mike Pence. But now you have the case that this is a federal piece of legislation, and the controversy is incredibly revealing. Here you have three Democratic congresswomen who have held a press conference and are now publicly opposing federal legislation that would outlaw abortion solely on the basis of gender or race when it comes to the unborn child. Now, as we saw in the case of Indiana, opposition to this legislation is itself the most telling issue. But now we're talking about it at a national level. We need to notice the accusations against the bill. The bill would outlaw any abortion solely for the reasons of killing the baby because it is of an unacceptable gender or an unacceptable race. The background of this has to do with the fact that sex selection abortion is something that is a major factor worldwide. So major that population experts indicate that there may be as many as 300 million missing women and girls because of sex selection abortion and infanticide, mostly in Asia. Now there comes the story telling us that these three congresswomen have come out accusing this bill. Now remember what the bill does. It simply outlaws abortion for the sole reason of the race or gender of the child as being itself racist and, of course, here comes the term, anti-choice. Here you see a society that worships at the altar of personal autonomy and choice to the very extent that it will oppose legislation that might save the life of a baby singularly targeted in the womb because of the issue of race or gender. Now, what we're looking at here is a total moral meltdown at the civilizational level. And even though these are just three Democratic congresswomen, the very fact that they felt the need to stand before the American people and oppose this legislation, and the very fact that they accused it of being both racist and anti-choice, tells us that it is the choice issue that is now so predominant that it can only be described as a certain form of idolatry, now becoming increasingly common in America. As NBC and other members of the major media cover the story, they tend to look at the opposition to the bill, and they also cite as an open question whether or not sex selection abortion is really a big problem in America. But remember, just in recent days on The Briefing, unrelated to this development in the United States, we went to the Toronto Globe and Mail and documented the fact that medical authorities in Canada are now increasingly concerned that sex selection abortion is something that is going on there in that country, primarily from immigrants coming from Asian communities. Now, explicit in the Canadian conversation is raising the question as to whether or not it is appropriate to deal with this issue because it raises issues of racial stereotyping. And yet, on the other hand, there is no question that worldwide, when we talk about sex selection abortion, it is a geographically and ethnically concentrated problem. And it is concentrated primarily in countries including China and India that exhibit a radical preference for sons rather than daughters. And the numbers there are irrefutable. These are long-standing problems, but they have been exacerbated by modern technology that now allows the identification of the unborn child by gender and the possible targeting of that unborn child for abortion simply based upon the gender identification. The Christian worldview trains us to ask a very important question, and that is this: how far can you press an argument? What we now see is that the argument for human autonomy, the argument that underlies the entire edifice of abortion, is now pressed to the point that when you ask the question, does that extend even to defending abortions undertaken solely for the reason of the race or gender of the baby? The answer to that, coming from these three Democratic congresswomen, evidently is yes. That leads to one of the major quandaries of our time. In the name of women's rights, modern feminism is more committed to abortion than to the lives of baby girls. That is difficult to explain, and even more difficult to comprehend. Next, we go back across the northern border to Canada, where that nation's government is trying to establish how they will legalize assisted suicide, in particular, physician-assisted suicide. As Ian Austin reports for the New York Times, the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau introduced legislation last week to legalize physician-assisted suicide for Canadians with a, quote, serious and incurable illness, which has brought them, quote, enduring physical or psychological suffering, end quote. Now, notice even before we go any further, the fact that here both physical and psychological suffering are cited as adequate rationales for physician-assisted suicide. Austin reports the proposed law limits physician-assisted suicides to citizens and residents who are eligible to participate in the national healthcare system, an effort to prevent a surge in medical tourism among the dying from other countries, end quote. Now, that's very interesting. As a matter of fact, the front page of the section of USA Today covering the story included this, quote, Canada unveils death bill. That's the headline. And the subtitle is assisted suicide legislation would exclude Americans. As Bacon explains, the government of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is concerned that the legislation, if it did not include this qualification, could entice thousands of Americans to look to Canada as the destination for euthanasia or assisted suicide. Holding these articles in the New York Times and USA Today also points to one of the moral contradictions at the heart of the story. As John Bacon of USA Today reports, people with psychiatric problems also would be excluded and no advance consent would be allowed. Meanwhile, Ian Austin reporting in the New York Times tells us that the law would officially authorize assisted suicide for those enduring either physical or psychological suffering, end quote. Perhaps you see the moral contradiction here. On the one hand, you have USA Today saying that people with psychiatric problems would be excluded. On the other hand, you have the New York Times saying that people who are enduring psychological suffering would be included. Now, what's the story? Well, the story is this. If the person's psychological or psychiatric problem is defined as suffering, they might be candidates. But if indeed they are judged to be not psychologically or psychiatrically stable to make the decision, they would be excluded. What's the point here? The point here is the inherent subjective determination of which is which. What we are watching here is a slide to assisted suicide that cannot possibly stop where this legislation seeks to draw the line in Canada. It hasn't held the line elsewhere, and it certainly will not hold the line in Canada. As a matter of fact, the Canadian legislation seems to be aware of problems that have occurred in European nations that have legalized physician-assisted suicide, but the Canadian legislation offers absolutely no objective barriers to Canada following in the very same direction. Now, you'll recall that when physician-assisted suicide is usually defended, it is defended in the face of what's defined as a terminal illness. But as the New York Times tells us, officials in Canada said that a patient would not have to have a terminal condition, citing an example of someone with an immune system deficiency which leaves them vulnerable to lethal infections. Rather than limiting assisted suicide to those who are diagnosed with so-called terminal diseases, the Canadian legislation would actually offer physician-assisted suicide when patients are defined as suffering intolerably or facing a foreseeable death. Now, just to note the obvious, to be human is to face a foreseeable death. What this really gets to is the inherent subjectivity in these guidelines. Once you accept the fact that people have the right to bring about their death and to request a physician to assist them, once you bless doctors not only to heal but to kill, the ultimate issues become so subjective that it is simply a matter of which doctor will make the determination under what conditions to bring about euthanasia. As we have seen many times before, the great worldview divide is particularly apparent on an issue like physician-assisted suicide. That was made clear in a recent article in the London newspaper The Guardian when Anne Newman asked the question, is physician-assisted suicide humane or sacrilegious? Now, that does reveal the dividing line very clearly. I would not choose under normal circumstances to use her terminology, but it does work. The two words, humane on the one hand and sacrilegious on the other. Those who are arguing for physician-assisted suicide argue that it is a humane option, but we need to note what that requires. It requires abandoning the biblical worldview that says the human dignity is based upon the fact that every human being is made in the image of God, and rather moving to some other definition of human dignity that grounds it into something inherently subjective. It is going to be forever a moving target. Meanwhile, the word sacrilegious implies the fact that it would be morally and theologically wrong to take the act. Why? The word sacrilegious points to a holy authority, and that is the authority of God alone to determine when we shall live and when we shall die. We saw human autonomy taking on idolatrous dimensions in the story on abortion, and we see it repeated again now. In the name of human autonomy, we will demand when we will end our lives and on what terms. Ann Newman's article makes very clear the great worldview divide by stipulating that the only powerful arguments against physician-assisted suicide are inherently theological, and they are coming from the Christian church, or at least from the Christian church that still believes in the authority of Scripture and in the fact that every single human being is made in the image of God. And at this point, we have to bring in an incredibly important story from an unexpected source. The Christian Century has been the flagship masthead of liberal Protestantism for well over a century. As a matter of fact, the very title of the magazine, coming from the early decades of the 20th century, harkens back to the triumphalism of Protestant liberalism in the early decades of that century. But as we come to the story today, the cover story in the Christian Century is a story that offers incredible cautions about physician-assisted suicide, coming in a magazine that generally approves of the idea of euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide and has run articles supportive of those issues ever since the 1970s and 80s. But now we have Theo A. Bohr writing this cover story in the Christian Century, telling us that the slippery slope is slippery indeed. He says this: in the Netherlands, five regional review committees, this is of euthanasia and assisted suicide, each consisting of a lawyer, a physician, and an ethicist, were charged with keeping an eye on the practice of euthanasia and assisted suicide and assessing after the fact whether a case of assisted dying complied with the law. Now, in this article, Theo Bohr makes very clear that he has been not only a proponent of physician-assisted suicide, but he served on one of these review panels. What did that experience teach him? Bohr writes, quote, "For a decade and a half, this system, that is, the system in the Netherlands that would supposedly put limitations or boundaries on physician-assisted suicide," he said, "this system seemed to provide a means to stabilize the number of cases and prevent the expansion of grounds for seeking assisted dying. We told delegations," he writes from abroad, "that the Dutch solution was robust and humane. As recently as 2011, he writes, "I assured a European ecumenical audience that the Dutch system was a model worth considering." But then he writes this, quote, "But that conclusion has become harder and harder for me to support. For no apparent reason, beginning in 2007, the numbers of assisted dying cases started going up by 15% each year. In 2014, the number of cases stood at 5,306, nearly three times the number in 2002. As Bohr summarizes, with overall mortality numbers remaining level, this means that today 1 in 25 deaths in the Netherlands is the consequence of assisted dying. He then says this, and this is absolutely shocking, quote, "On top of these voluntary deaths, there are about 300 non-voluntary deaths where a patient is not judged competent annually." Now notice, here you have a member of a legal review committee in the Netherlands telling us that the practice of euthanasia there has now extended not only to so-called voluntary euthanasia, but to involuntary euthanasia. That means at least 300 cases in which the patient did not ask to be killed, but nonetheless was. Continuing his article, Bohr writes, quote, "A shift has also taken place in the type of patients who seek assisted dying. Whereas in the first years, the vast majority of patients, about 95%, were patients with a terminal disease who had their lives ended days or weeks before a natural death was expected, an increasing number of patients now seek assisted dying because of dementia, psychiatric illnesses, and accumulated age-related complaints. Terminal cancer," he says, "now accounts for fewer than 75% of the cases. Many of the remaining 25% could have lived for months, years, or even decades," end quote. Bohr is not completed with telling us of his concerns. He goes on to say that an increasing number of cases of assisted suicide and euthanasia in the Netherlands take place because the suffering, quote, "largely consists of being old, lonely, or bereaved." And then, almost like a bolt out of the blue, Theo Bohr gets right to the worldview issue that's so apparent in the Canadian example. Bohr writes, and I quote, "The issue now is autonomy, the patient's right to a swift death brought about by a doctor." Again, he says the issue is autonomy. But then, in even more striking language, he goes on to write, quote, in a way, this shift toward autonomy is natural. With societies becoming more secularized, why not claim a right to decide about one's own death? End quote. Now, that's exactly the issue, and it's exactly what is always at stake when the issue is physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. It is the claim of autonomy. It is a claim of autonomy, of individual, human, personal autonomy that only makes sense if there is no God. And we are not creatures of a holy God, but rather some kind of cosmic accident. As cosmic accidents, we would simply affirm in ourselves a total autonomy. After all, there is no creator who defined us and made us in his image. And thus, we would claim the right to decide when we will end our lives and on what terms. But you'll notice the inherent limitations to the secularized worldview of human autonomy. It's one thing to say, I will decide when I will die, but not a single one of us gets to decide when we are born, nor to whom we are born, nor where we are born, nor the circumstances of our birth. There are inherent limitations on human autonomy against which the modern secular worldview is pressing as hard as it can. All this has led Theo Bohr, who has been a member of one of the review committees, having been a supporter of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, to reconsider his position and to argue that no state, no government, and no doctor should be in the position of bringing about human death. Bohr concludes his article with a profoundly countercultural but morally urgent message when he writes, quote, societal involvement should be directed at providing high-quality care to all and protecting the lives of vulnerable people. Any law, he says, making assisted dying possible should stay clear of the impression that a society is ready to organize the killing of its citizens, even at their request. End quote. Finally, we were faced over the weekend with a very unusual photograph. The photograph was of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders with Pope Francis. What in the world is that all about? Those who are thinking from a Christian worldview need to look at it very straightforwardly and come to understand that, of course, it was no accident. Bernie Sanders claims to agree with the Pope on many economic issues, but, of course, he's at great difference with the Pope and with the Catholic Church on issues related to gay rights, same-sex marriage, abortion, and any number of other issues. But clearly, he saw political gain in the midst of the campaign for the New York primary and having a photograph taken with Pope Francis. So what do we need to learn from that photograph? We need to learn that politicians do political things. And we need to expect that when a politician leaves a presidential race at this point and goes to the Vatican to have a photograph made, it is because the candidate believes that he needs to. And of course, here you have the irony of the secular socialist Bernie Sanders standing with Pope Francis, but it raises a host of questions that we need to ask when a politician shows up at our own church. What exactly does that mean? Here's where we need to think just as carefully as those looking at the photograph of Bernie Sanders and the Pope. When a politician comes to our church and poses for a picture, does that mean they're standing with us on the totality of the Christian faith? At the very least, we ought to be asking the question. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. Remember the event that's going to take place next Monday night here at Southern Seminary. I'm going to be joining with veteran journalist Cal Thomas. We're going to be talking about God and politics. We're going to be talking just like we do here on The Briefing, but it's going to be a conversation. I'm very glad Cal Thomas is going to join me. The event is going to be at 7 o'clock on Monday night next week here on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. It is free to the public, and you can make your reservation by going to the website eventsatsouthern.com. For more information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.